My dear friends, fans, colleagues to Voices of the Sacred Feminine Radio, where we are busy here creating new stories because we know the stories we tell each other are sacred stories. They become our mythology, which then becomes our values, and thereby we begin to manifest that new normal. And if you think that's hyperbole, just look at how the Garden of Eden myth has shaped the lives of women and men for thousands of years. I believe it was foremother and feminist scholar Merlin Stone who called the Garden of Eden myth one of the earliest forms of political propaganda, shifting the psyches of humanity toward patriarchy and effectively relegating females to second-class status, even chattel for a time. You know, think of the myths and ideas we have today that shape, so many minds out there. We have Ayn Rand's rugged individualism and trickle-down economic mythology shaping politics and democracy. We even have ancient alien mythology, which has become sort of a secular religion. Stories told and retold shape conspiracy theories in the minds of the public, affecting outcomes of elections and world events. The Gospels, chosen and rejected for the Bible, were done so with an agenda leading to our patriarchal culture. What are the stories that shape how we look at 9/11, the war in Iraq, the assassination of JFK, even how we think about Thanksgiving and the history of Christmas? Well, most of us have come to realize patriarchy, otherwise known as rule by a male-dominated society that reveres solely a male god, well, it's not working too good for Mother Earth and most of the people on the planet. How do we counter bleats that there's no option but the authoritarian father? How does society go about making a course correction? How do ideas that permeate every level of society, from womb to tomb, boardroom to bedroom, voting booth to the workplace, shift into a more fair, equal, and just world of partnership, caring, sharing, and peace? It begins with reawakening, I think, and reinterpreting our earliest pre-patriarchal myths, the sacred stories of the feminine face of God. Imagine how that might look if we could restore her wisdom and reclaim it from the trash bin of history and return her values to the center of society. If we can remember, vision, and restore ancient truths, then we might just manifest it. So I think we need to get busy. You know, Thomas Paine, one of our forefathers, he said, "We have it in our power to make the world over again." And I love the quote from feminist Arundhati Roy, who says, "Another world is not only possible, she's on her way. And on a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." Yes, we can make the world a better place. Don't listen to the fearmongers and the naysayers. Don't listen to those who would have you scapegoat the other. Don't be distracted from the real issues and solutions. Follow those of us, women and men, who are blazing a new trail with pink-handled machetes. Well, I have a great show for you tonight. I'm so happy to say one of my mentors is back on Voices of the Sacred Feminine. When people ask me whose work most influenced me, it's this woman's name that passes my lips. Rhianne Eisler is here. Her book, The Chalice and the Blade, started me down this path back in the 90s, and over the years, she's pivoted from discussing her story to teaching us about social justice, caring economies, and how partnership leads to prosperity. Tonight, we're going to discuss exactly that, as well as what choosing partnership over dominator model of society can mean for the most of us, for women, children, the elderly, basically so many of the 99%. We'll talk about why it's good business for corporations to care, too, and stop exploiting us and the environment. And last week, if you tuned in, we had the economist Richard Wolff on the show discussing how to cure capitalism and what models we can adopt to have a more prosperous economic future. Well, tonight's show, I think, is a great follow-up to that, as Rhianne tells us about SWEIS, S-W-E-I-S. It's a new kind of economic indicator beyond the GDP, And like I said last week, this isn't going to be a conversation that makes your eyes glaze over. You don't need to have had one class in economics to understand what we'll be talking about. You'll understand what we're talking about with your heart and your good common sense. You know, maybe you've heard Bernie Sanders answering Barbara Walters' question recently about what one word would describe his presidency. And his answer was compassion. I think you'll see what we're talking about tonight is about basic fairness, justice, partnership, caring, and compassion, so we all have a better quality of life. We all should be questioning our quality of life loudly and often. I think Rianne's work helps us speak the language we need to speak to tell these new stories and shift our consciousness to that new normal in society. So don't go away. I have to first take a moment to tell you about a wonderful coffee table book, and then we're going to get right back to Rianne. Because this coffee table book arrived in the mail from Joe Carson. You might have heard Joe's commercial here when we've talked about her documentary, Dancing with Gaia. Well, now she's got something new out there I want to share with you. The book is titled Celebrate Wildness, and I have to give you my personal take on it. It was really impressive. I really couldn't take my eyes off of it. I was enthralled, turning from one page to another with the art of Fred Adams, the foreword by Polk Runyon, who's a master ritualist. This is an exceptional book, and I hope you'll look into it and think about it when you're adding to your library or your coffee table, because it's a great conversation starter. No wonder it's been called scintillating, rapturous, filled with erotically charged ritual, with an overall vision of human culture utterly defined by wilderness, eros, and goddess. You can check it out by going to ferropharia.org, and the title again is Celebrate Wildness, Magic, Mirth, and Love on the Ferropharia Path, edited by Joe Carson, who is a longtime supporter of the show. And thanks to Alea Dejo for the use of her music tonight. Tonight's cut was called Awaken. Yes, Awaken. Not so subtle, am I? Yes, it's time I think more and more people are hearing the call to awaken. But now it's time to let you hear from Rianne Eisler. And before I say hello to her, I'm going to read you part of her bio. If by some chance this is the first time you're hearing of this incredible foremother and visionary, the woman so many of us call mentor. Dr. Rianne Eisler, she keynotes conferences worldwide. She's a consultant to business and government on applications of the partnership model that she introduced in her work. She speaks at the United Nations and international venues, have included Germany at the invitation of the German Parliament. Also, the chair of Volkswagen International invited her to speak to them. The mayor of Bogota, the Czech Republic, and she was invited by the president there. She's internationally known for her bestseller, The Chalice and the Blade, Our History, Our Future, which is now in 23 languages. And some of those languages actually include Chinese, Russian, Korean, Hebrew, Japanese, Arabic. And her newest book, The Real Wealth of Nations, Creating Caring Economics, proposes a new approach to economics that gives visibility and value to the most essential human work, the work of caring for people and the planet. And this book, The Real Wealth of Nations, has been hailed by people like Desmond Tutu, Gloria Steinem, Jane Goodall. She has multiple books, The Power of Partnership, Seven Relationships That Will Change Your Life, Tomorrow's Children, A Blueprint for Partnership Education in the 21st Century, as well as Sacred Pleasure, Sex Myth and the Politics of the Body, Women, Men, and the Global Quality of Life. She's written over 300 articles and publications ranging from behavioral science, futures, political psychology, the Christian Science Monitor, the UNESCO Courier. I have to say, I'm honored to say she's in my little anthology, Voices of the Sacred Feminine, Conversations to Reshape Our World. And, you know, some background, what we don't hear about her often, is she was born in Vienna. She fled from the Nazis with her parents to Cuba and later emigrated to the United States, where she obtained degrees in sociology and law from the University of California. She taught pioneering classes on women and the law at UCLA and now teaches in the Transformative Leadership Program at the California Institute of Integral Studies. She's a member of the General Evolution Research Group, a fellow of the World Academy of Art and Science and World Business Academy, a counselor of the World Future Council. I could go on and on here. She was even the only woman among 20 great thinkers selected for inclusion in macro history and macro historians, in recognition of the lasting importance of her work as a cultural historian and evolutionary theorist. She's received many honors and degrees. And, wow, you know, Rhianne, you have done more work than some people do in 10 lifetimes. Please, welcome to the show.
Well, it's where a pleasure to be with you again.
Well, where do you find the time? You know, what was your inspiration? Could it have been having to flee the Nazis at such a tender age, or did that start it all for you, or was it something else?
Well, I think that did start it for me. Of course, you know, that was very traumatic. I was a little child, and I couldn't understand what was happening. And when I did finally understand, when I found out, you know, that most of my extended family, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, had been killed in the Holocaust, you know, I started to try to understand why there is so much cruelty and so much violence, and what can we do to change that. And that really was very much the impetus for my research. But there was also something else that happened much, much later, when in the late 60s I woke up, like so many other women, to understand that as much as having been born Jewish had really obviously impacted my life rather, shall we say, strongly, having been born female, having really been born female, had also had a huge influence. You know, it was sort of like waking up from a long sleep, because we had taken it so for granted that, well, that our place was really a secondary place. And so I threw myself, of course, into the women's movement. I wrote actually the well, some of my very first books came out of my background as an attorney, and I worked very hard for women's rights. But I also, after I wrote the Equal Rights Handbook on the Equal Rights Amendment, which was the only mass paperback, by the way, but it was too late. Basically, you know, when it was defeated, you know, I started to think, well, what's really needed is a cultural transformation. And that took me back to the questions of my childhood. And however, when I did my research, then I really paid attention to, yes, to the status of women, and in looking at social patterns. And that's one of the distinguishing features of my work, that most studies are what they're called the study of man, right? And man really does not include woman. So so that was one of the distinguishing features. So that was a long answer.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm thinking back to those years ago, you know, when I read your book, The Chalice and the Blade, you know, and as I said, you know, it really became the foundation for my belief in goddess spirituality. You know, it, you know, proved this feminine face of God idea, you know, wasn't a feminist fantasy. And I remember at the very back of the book, of The Chalice and the Blade, you sort of teased us with the idea, you know, of partnership over domination, and you brought to the fore that dominator pyramid. you know, how, you know, well, I guess I'm wondering, you know, back then, you know, before you became who you are today and you've, you know, you've made so many accomplishments, did goddess spirituality or a feminine face of God, you know, fit into your life as a spirituality, or was it more of an archetype or a value, or, you know, how did that, you know, fit into your overall, you know, spiritual or psychological outlook?
I think that it was really the other way around, that it was the research for the chalice and the blade, which, of course, as you know, really showed the long, long tradition of what we today call the feminine divine or women's spirituality. It was that very profoundly influenced me. For example, I realized my mother, every Friday night, she would say a ritual, beautiful ritual, with her hands, a prayer over the candles. And the prayer was about asking the bride, the kala, to return. And that it acquired a completely different meaning for me, because I realized that this was a remnant in Jewish tradition of a time when women were priestesses, when the sacred marriage of the goddess and the god was celebrated, you know, the kala, the bride, was being welcomed. And it was very meaningful for me. In fact, people, you know, like you, who have read The Chalice and the Blade, have told me that it has completely transformed the way that they look at their lives and at the world, including our past and present and possible future. And doing the research did that for me, too. Let me just say, really including women's status, how the feminine is defined, how the masculine is defined, as part of my research, made it possible to see these patterns of what I then called the dominator or domination system and the partnership system. And in both of these alternatives, and it's really a continuum, it's you know, a matter of degree, the status of women plays an enormously vital role.
Well, yeah. All right. Well, that makes sense, because, you know, really I was trying to see how you segued from finding a feminine face of God to discovering the, like you said, you called it the cultural patterns, the pattern of, you know, domination and partnership. And obviously we associate partnership more with the sacred feminine and domination more with patriarchy. Was there any, you know, one particular thing that sort of, you know, solidified that idea for you, or was it just the whole history or herstory of, you know, of the subjugation of the feminine that, you know, helped create in your mind that that dominator pyramid?
Well, no. The dominator pyramid is there in reality, not just in my mind, and so is what I call the partnership configuration. I mean, what happened is that because I drew from this much larger database than most studies of human society, one that includes the whole of humanity, both its female and male halves, as well as the whole of our history, including the thousands of years of our prehistory, and also because I looked at the whole of our lives, not just what's conventionally defined as politics and economics, but where we all live in our family and other intimate relations, what I was able to see are patterns. And there were no names for these patterns, for these configurations. And that's when I coined the terms partnership model and domination model. But you see, each has its own configuration. If you look, for example, today at one of the most regressive societies on the planet, ISIS or ISIL or whatever the acronym you use, It has a very powerful domination configuration. It is rigid theocratic rule, and that rule is not only in the state or tribe, but in the family. Secondly, it's the rigid subordination of women, and with it, of anything stereotypically considered feminine, whether in a woman or a man, such as caring, nonviolence, caregiving. And third, a very high degree of built-in, even idealized violence. But if you look, for example, at another contemporary set of societies, societies like Sweden, Finland, Norway, they're not ideal, but they conform more to the partnership configuration. They have more democracy in both the family and the state. They have much more gender equality. I mean, women are about 40% to 50% of the national legislature. And third, they've been trying, they're in the forefront of trying to leave behind traditions of violence. The first peace studies came out of those nations. They have a strong men's movement to disentangle a so-called masculinity from its association with domination and violence. The first laws prohibiting violence, physical discipline against children and families came out of those nations. That's the partnership configuration. So
right.
It's what I discovered out in the world and through thousands of years, going back to our prehistory at a time when we did orient more to the partnership configuration, and yes, a time when there was more gender partnership, and of course, as a corollary, the feminine divine was acknowledged and venerated.
Right. And I should clarify, I probably didn't choose my words, carefully enough. I really wasn't trying to say this was an idea that was in your own mind. I was just trying to say, when did you connect the dots between the dominator and partnership models being associated with the sacred feminine? And I understand it's a reflection of what you saw in history. It was a reflection of what you were seeing out there in the world. And obviously, it makes perfect sense. And I wonder too if when you first started out, I found this to be my experience, and I guess that's the source of this question. You know, it's a lot harder, I think, to get people to talk about changing society when you start the conversation from the place of a feminine face of God, you know, because so many of them, you know, especially if like myself, I mean, I grew up a Catholic in Louisiana. I was 30 before I knew anything about goddess spirituality. Of course, I had Mary in my background, but she's, you know, benign and passive, you know, kind of the way patriarchy would love, I think, most women to be, you know, as opposed to some of these more, you know, powerful goddesses who give us maybe a warrioress archetype or other archetypes. And, I find it perhaps difficult sometimes to start this conversation about let's change society when you are talking about a feminine face of God, when some people don't even know that or acknowledge that, or it might go against, you know, their spiritual upbringing. And, you know, it's like before you can even get to the politics, you know, you have to talk about religion. And wow, you know, it's you know, two subjects that are sometimes hard to talk about out in the world. You know, it causes so much strife, you know, if you will. You know, I wonder if it's easier to talk about economics and leave the whole spirituality angle out of it. Have you found that?
Well, yes and no. Depends on who it is you're talking to and how you frame it. And I agree with you. My gosh, I mean, after The Chalice and the Blade was published. And by the way, it's you read an older biography. It's now in 26 foreign editions. It was last year, as a matter of fact, acquired by a Turkish publisher. So, I mean, beg your pardon?
I was saying that's very cool. It's growing after all of these years, and it just, you know, it still has a wonderful, wonderful interest out there.
Well, it's cited a lot, and it's used a lot. And I still get mail from people who just discovered it and say, oh, my gosh, I mean, how come I didn't know about this? I don't know how come. But, the thing about it is this. You're quite right. I mean, fairy tales and religion. People, we are taught these before our brains are fully formed, before certainly our critical faculties are there, and that's why people believe these rather imaginative stories, to put it nicely. But the thing about it is about the divine feminine. Depends on who you're talking to. If you are talking to somebody who really is interested in politics, as I am very much, then you could make them understand that the women's spirituality movement and the reclamation of the feminine divine, the reclamation of the priesthood for women, is really part of the challenge to a domination system. I think you've probably noticed that I don't use the terms matriarchy and patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, because they're really two sides of a dominator coin, right? Semantically speaking. I mean, whether it's ruled by women or ruled by men. So we're trapped even by our language, aren't we? People feel very freed when they realize that there is a partnership alternative and that it really has a lot to do with how the roles and relations of the two fundamental halves of humanity, women and men, are structured. So I'm always very happy when men do give the Chalice and the Blade or Sacred Pleasure or more recently other books to people in their families or their friends. Because it is, as these guys tell me, it's an inclusive model.
Yes, yes. Well, and you're right, you know, because matriarchy, how do we know that it wouldn't just be patriarchy in a skirt? And so I find myself talking about egalitarian societies more often. And you find, too, that, you know, sometimes people will shut down if you use the word patriarchy because they jump to this conclusion that, you're against men, you know, as opposed to, you're just trying to create a world of equality and, you know, level playing fields.
Well, I think it's more men, especially younger men, are beginning to understand that what I call a domination system and the cornerstone of that system is male dominance and the devaluation of the so-called feminine, the soft, whether it's in a woman or a man. You know, we call men sissies, wimps, right?
Mm-hmm,
you know, effeminate is an insult. I mean,
right.
Which is a reflection of what we have to leave behind. But I think more and more men are understanding that these rigid gender roles, you know, to rank one sex, one half of humanity over the other half, requires very rigid roles, because otherwise how do you distinguish that one is supposedly better than the other, right?
Yes.
Many men are beginning to realize that that's a straitjacket that has really imprisoned not only women, but men, depriving both of part of their humanity.
Yes, yes. No one can be their authentic self. It just puts us in these tiny little boxes, and a recipe for, maybe an unhappy life, certainly. Well, Rhianne, why don't you, you know, for people who maybe haven't read The Chalice and the Blade, you know, maybe just, you know, briefly talk about what the dominator pyramid is, Because, you know, I find that sometimes I go out there and I'll talk about a dominator model and Reanne Eisler's dominator pyramid, and some people have yet to understand it or discover it. So if you would, maybe just a brief explanation.
Well, it's that configuration that I mentioned when I gave the example of ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic Caliphate or whatever you want to call it. It really consists of top-down rule in both the family and the state or tribe, and the two go together. This is what's so interesting. You know, regressives, I mean, whether it's so-called religious fundamentalists who are Muslim or Christian, they realize in their gut that the subordination of women is one of the cornerstones of that pyramid, whereas so many progressives still think of it as just a women's issue, right? And
mm-hmm.
So our job is really, to a very large extent, also awakening other people who want a different, more egalitarian, more, well, kinder, really kinder, not, you know, fairer, more, you know, more caring society.
Right.
I mean, you know, it is not coincidental that whether it was Khomeini in Iran or Hitler in Germany, that getting women back into their so-called traditional place, which is a code word for subservient, was one of their top priorities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the domination system. So, but what I found in The Chalice and the Blade, and this is really important, you know, we've been told, you know, that caveman cartoon, right? That male dominance, violence, you know, domination, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is just, you know, the way it always was, and by implication, the way it always has to be. Well, the reality, as I discovered, and as more and more people are discovering, is that actually our earlier prehistoric societies, until just about really 5,000 years ago, and in some places even less, oriented more to the partnership side. And one of the most interesting pieces of evidence are, of course, all of the feminine goddess figurines. I mean, you know, museums in the basement, they're littered with these figurines, but it's a labeling issue. They call them women, whereas if they find a male figure, you know, it's a prince, it's a chief.
Or it's a fertility. They want to just limit it to a fertility object or something.
That is correct. Or as they did in the 19th century, to some form of bizarre ancient pornography, right? Because they're nude and they have a very clearly defined pubic triangle and the breasts are there. I mean, it's so interesting what people project in interpreting archaeological findings. And, of course, this takes us back to what you were saying. We're almost imprinted, aren't we? But, you know, as a Catholic, I mean, Mary, that is the most bizarre Holy Family, where only the Father and the Son are divine, and the Mother, you know, the Mother of God is the only mortal. I mean, obviously, it's the goddess demoted, right?
Yes. Yeah, and, you know, and unfortunately, too, she can only be half a woman in the sense that she can have no sexuality either because, you know, that's taboo. I mean, how can, you know, it's such a difficulty to even have her as a role model, you know, because you would feel bad about your sexuality and, you know, you would just always be kind of barefoot in the kitchen. You know, you'd never speak up and you'd just do whatever the males in your life told you to do. Yeah, suffering.
Yeah, you just suffer. That was her example, her role model. Subordinate, you know, and suffering. And, of course, it's a miserable role model, isn't it? But, you know, so many people turn to Mary just as they turn to Kuan Yin. You know, because we have this yearning still for the mother, for the divine feminine, and maybe we can start there if you're talking about religion.
Well, you know, I think too, one of the things I've said, and you know, and I don't, obviously don't have any scholarship to back this up. It's more, you know, woman's intuition. But if you're someone that believes in Jesus and Mary, I can imagine that she learned that he learned his social justice at the knee of his mother. You know,
that's a lovely point. I just love that.
It is difficult, you know, growing up with, you know, even though I feel like, you know, of course, the sacred feminine stayed alive in the guise of Mary, you know, it's really done a disservice to women everywhere, you know, to, in a sense, you know, have that as their role model because they can't be whole people.
But, you know, it's not just Christianity. I mean, first of all, you know, I mean, if you start with Eve, as you know, I mean, yeah, the propaganda value of that story is amazing, isn't it? But there was also the Pandora story.
Yes.
You know, which from a culture that was not Christian or Jewish or anything like that. And if you look at Hindu, sure, I mean, there's Shakti and there's Shiva, but Shakti, the woman, if you look at the iconography, half the time she's about half his size, right? So you get the message, don't you? Hey, she's there, but she's not that important. And anyway, he is supreme, right?
Yeah.
And
the
Buddha, I mean, my gosh, he had to sit under the Bodhi tree and give up sex, right? Because being in contact with women, and some Buddhist priests to this day will not even touch a woman for fear of being contaminated. So I don't think that it's just, you know, the Abrahamic religions. It's something that happened in our prehistory, this shift to a dominator system. And, hey, they made up all kinds of different stories to justify it.
Well, and I'm wondering, you know, I know there's books out there that talk about how patriarchy came along. I think somebody recommended The Rule of Mars to me, but I haven't had a chance to pick it up yet. I think it's one of those expensive $70 books. But
wow, I didn't know. I've got an article in it. I didn't know it was so expensive. That's
well, I think it is.
Well, that's
I think it is.
That's a shame.
But, I say that because I think it's more of an academic book, but I wonder, do you think it, you know, patriarchy just came along in different places differently? I mean, do you think...
Well, first of all, in Sacred Pleasure, which is really one of my favorite books, you know, the subtitle of it is Sex, Myth, and the Politics of the Body. And it really looks at both spirituality and sexuality using the lenses of the partnership domination continuum, and it really shows the transformation. But I think, yes, it did come along in different ways, in different places, but certainly there's a lot of evidence that what happened, and this is what I really discuss in some length in Sacred Pleasure. If you haven't read it, do pick it up because you'll love it. The first part really is about the transformation of the sacred marriage and of the goddess. I mean, like Demeter, first she becomes Saint Demetra, you know, under Christianity, and then she has a sex change and she becomes Saint Demetrios. So, you see, the remissing process, it's fascinating to trace that. Or the sacred marriage, you know, from this sexual and spiritual union that you read about in the cuneiform tablets of Sumer about Inanna and her partner, the Demutzi, and she is the great goddess, right, who brings, the, you know, fertility, and she brings love, etc., etc. And then you have a basically, in a very strange for a homophobic religion, you have a marriage between this male god and his male priests, right? In the church.
Yes.
That becomes the sacred marriage. So the whole thing is fascinating. But anyway, getting back to your question, there's a lot of evidence that basically what happened is that during a time of massive climate change, areas that became really deserts, where there was no possibility of farming and herding, pastoralism, rather than farming became the norm. And then, of course, pastoralism, like cow grazing, you know, cattle grazing, even further depletes the soil. That wave after wave of incursions, of invasions from these nomadic pastoralists came down and took over and really, in many cases, completely exterminated the more peaceful, more egalitarian, more gender-balanced societies. So one of the lessons for our future is that this shift has to be global. In other words, you can't just go into, well, we'll disarm, because if we do, we'll have ISIL or whoever else comes up, you know, taking us over, right? A more rigid,
right.
More rigid domination regime.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, and I think I was hearing you describe maybe the Maria Gimbutas theories. Is does that sound right to you? Her Kurgan invasion.
I've drawn from her work, but I've also drawn from the work of all people, Gordon Child, who remarked about this. He adored the Indo-Europeans, you know, the invaders, the Aryans. But he did remark that all the goddess figurines disappear all of a sudden, and there are signs of warfare that they didn't used to be. But she really did discuss it in more detail. I've also drawn from the work of James DeMeo. Anyway, I always draw from more than one source.
Sure, sure. Well, in getting back to the sacred sexuality, you know, I've often thought that the power. I want to say this, you know, say this carefully. I mean, sexuality is such a powerful thing for for women and men, and it seems like to me that maybe. Men were afraid of the power women would have over them through sexuality, and do you think that played into anything that
no,
you know?
Thing, I mean, either men were very dumb not to get it that you know that they play a part in reproduction, or they're just brutes, and I don't believe either one. I mean, I think it has to do a lot with, to begin with, I think domination systems came out of arid environments, where, if you will, the earth was not a good mother. But once a pattern becomes established culturally, it will persist in any environment. You know, you can see that historically, okay? So I don't think is that men... we're afraid of women's sexuality. Sexuality gives both women and men a lot of pleasure. So
right.
Why would they be afraid of it?
Well, I just thought perhaps, it's easier to maybe get men to go off to war if they're not happy at home. You know, they can use that aggression. they can use that aggression to go off to war rather than, you know, if they're home sated and content and, you know, happy with their life. what is that story, Lysistrata? Is that the...
That is a Greek comedy, from Aristophanes. I have a wonderful chapter in the in Sacred Pleasure. You really have to read it.
I do.
So you will love it. But the thing about it is that Lysistrata is really a parody about sort of a women's movement where women refuse men's sex unless they get out of that disastrous war that they were in, which they didn't. So there was something like a women's movement in ancient Athens, and that was sort of like a comedy about it. But the thing about it is I have a chapter in there because the Athenians were terribly male-dominant, my God, and it's by a classicist. I used her title for my chapter, The Reign of the Phallus, and that's in the... part where you already see the shift. But this is Strata is about women withholding sex from men.
Right. And now Spike Lee has something like that out now. I'm trying to think of the title, but it's either out now or it's about to come out, where they've sort of done a parody of the of Lysistrata, and it's interesting. Well, so Rhian, so you go from Chalice and the Blade to, I think, The Power of Partnership and
And the Blade to Sacred Pleasure.
Okay.
And then I wrote a book on education called Tomorrow's Children, which is a totally gender balanced, among other things, curriculum, because, if you've noticed, our curricula are not gender balanced, but which is another problem that we have. I mean, there's so much to do. Then I wrote The Power of Partnership, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm glad for the clarity, because I didn't have it in the proper order. Well, where I was leading to was where and when did the Center for Partnership Studies, when was that born in this journey that you're taking with, all of this wonderful research you're providing humanity?
Well, actually, that was born the year that The Chalice and the Blade was published, because we were inundated by mail. At the time, we didn't have the 87. We didn't have, of course, email and the internet and the social media. People who wanted to be together, do something, and so we incorporated this not-for-profit. And one of the first things that happened was that the former First Lady of Greece, Margarita Papandreou, hosted the first international conference on partnership. You should go to our website. It's centerforpartnership.org, and you'll see the history of it. And it's a fascinating history, which has, in a sense, followed the trajectory of my books, so that now it's very much dealing with all of them. I mean, we have webinars, online courses, which are just fabulous. I mean, people from all over the world. We've had people now from 19 nations globally, and from almost every U.S. state, because they're online, so people can take them. So we are launching, as a matter of fact, The Power of Partnership as an online course based on that book. I teach a webinar called Changing Our Story, Changing Our Lives and Cultural Transformation, which really follows the trajectory of my work. The Power of Partnership starts in, I think, January or early February, and I do my course, I think, not until March, I can't remember, but the majority of our online courses are really inspired by my book, The Real Wealth of Nations, Creating a Caring Economics, and we certify caring economy advocates from all over the world to change our economic system, which is urgent. And that's, you mentioned the social wealth economic indicators. It was part of our Caring Economy campaign that we developed these new metrics.
Well, why don't you explain a little bit about the social wealth economic indicators, why they're so important, and what they are, as opposed to GDP, which doesn't give the whole picture.
Well, GDP not only doesn't give the whole picture, but it gives a completely distorted picture. I mean, it basically includes, let me give you an example. Making cigarettes, the medical bills resulting from them, the funeral bills, they're all great for GDP. Oil spills are wonderful for GDP. The cleanup costs, the lawsuits, the attorneys, that's all in GDP. But GDP also, and this is not only true of GDP, but of most, in fact, of all of the major so-called GDP alternatives, gives absolutely no value to the work, well, either very low value because it's so devalued, or no value if it's done in the home, the work of caring for people, starting in early childhood. And the social wealth economic indicators basically show the economic value of that work, and they also compare where the United States stands with other developed nations and shows that we have to catch up, not only because the disproportionate poverty of women worldwide is largely due to the fact that this care work, which is still primarily done by women, is either paid so very low or not paid at all, and we're the only developed nation that doesn't, for example, have paid parental leave, that doesn't have any caregiver tax credits, that doesn't have any stipends for families to help care for children. And we've got to do this not only because of the poverty that this causes and the injustice that it represents, but because caring for children, we know from neuroscience, is the most important factor in producing that high-quality human capital that we're told is essential for our knowledge service age, right?
Right.
So we make both an economic argument and a social justice argument. And these ways, so I really want to invite people, go to caringeconomy.org, and you can find out all about this. And it's really very important work, and we would like to convert the SWAYs, as we call them for short, to an index, you know, because one of the advantages of GDP is just one number. It's an index. So if anybody knows of funding, because, you know, foundation funding or if it's a corporation, please let us know.
Well, you know, if your work were adopted, you know, across the board, and you know, it would so greatly improve, you know, the lives of children and families. And you know, I listened to some of the introductory podcasts, webinars that the Center for Partnership had recently. And what I wondered is there anything in the program that would also address, you know, for the elderly, you know, for women who so many retire in poverty?
Oh, yes, of course. Well, first of all, I mean, the statistics on the elderly. In the United States, in our wealthy country, women over the age of 65 are twice as likely, well, they're twice as poor as men of the same age. And it's not only workplace discrimination, it's because most of these women are or were either full or part-time caregivers at home, and that work is not supported in any way.
Right.
I mean, this, you know, and it also, of course, the very low wages for caregivers in the market, many of whom are African American or Latina or immigrant women of another kind, that, I mean, most of these people are living below poverty.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, Rianne, I know so many more and more white women who are reaching retirement age, and you know, they're scared to death, you know, because they don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, and you know, all they can hear are, you know, Republicans wanting to privatize Social Security and or do away with it, and I mean, a lot of people would be living under a bridge. I mean, even with Social Security, it's poverty wages, you know?
Well, that's why in the spiritual community, some people don't vote. And I really think that's a terrible mistake because, yeah, we're not going to get somebody perfect, but somebody like Hillary Clinton is going to be, well, she has a tremendous record of looking out for women and children. And so I think that she's a very, very important to vote for.
Well, and I have to ask you, because I'll be honest, I've been, as much as I'd love to see a woman president, I've been leaning, you know, toward Bernie. And I mean, why do you think she would be better than Bernie?
Well, first of all, Bernie doesn't have a chance. I mean, this is a guy who spent his honeymoon in the Soviet Union and who calls himself a socialist. I mean, no matter what you may think, Americans aren't going to vote for him. So it's a throwaway vote. It was like for Nader, and look at who we got. But secondly, even aside from that, okay, he's a good man, but except for his stand on gun control, which is lousy.
Mm-hmm.
But She is so much better, so much more experienced, and she gets things done. I mean, this is a woman who has a look. I mean, she's also an original thinker, and she has tremendous values. I mean, when she came out of Yale, she could have had a job with one of the big law firms. She went to work for the children's fund. You know, I mean,
yeah. Well, you're not worried about her being too close to, you know, Monsanto and, you know, her not wanting to break up the big banks and, you know, her being a little bit too corporatist. It would just be, you know, more of the same rather than, you know, making...
Look, my dear,
you know,
I'm not worried. Look at Obama. I mean, his health care program was a tremendous boon to the insurance companies, oh my God,
mm-hmm.
and to the
mm-hmm.
HMOs. But he promised all kinds of things, and in the end, he had to work with them, okay?
Right, yeah.
So I think that somebody who is willing and able to work with these people is going to do a much, much better job than somebody who just has a lot of rhetoric.
Okay. Well, you know, fair enough. That's your thoughts. Well, you know, I had Richard Wolff on the show last week, and he's—I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He's a professor and economist, and you know, he was talking about one of the things that would help the economy would be employee-owned businesses. And you know, I wonder if you know if you had any thoughts on other things we might be able to do to, you know, help move us toward a more, you know, environment where we do take care of the people, you know, before
well,
we take care of the corporations.
Hillary Clinton has rolled out some of her plans. One of them is caregiver credits for taking care of the elderly. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She has, when she was Secretary of State, she insisted that our foreign policy take into account the status of women. I mean, in other nations. That was a breakthrough. I'm afraid that the old leftist politics of a Bernie Sanders or of an Obama, as a matter of fact, really leave us thinking we're going to get something that we are not going to get. I think that, as I said, one-third of American women live in poverty or on the brink, according to the latest Shriver report. Now, and I wrote an article for that piece, by the way, on why one of the reasons that I just said is that because care work is so devalued. So if we really are serious about doing something about the disproportionate poverty of women and also of the African-American community, we have to have policies that will give visibility and value to care work. Hillary will. Sanders hasn't said boo about it. Because
okay. It's
not in his... anyway, I want to live to see a woman president. and if we're talking about women's spirituality, that is so important. Because it gives us a model of a woman of power.
True. Well, I wanted to also ask you about Finland. Finland, I think, is moving toward this idea of stipends for people, you know, because of income disparity, because of robotics. There just aren't enough jobs to keep everybody employed. And I know you know, hold up some of the Scandinavian countries and their policies as something we should aspire to. I wonder what you think about that, and do you think there's a way we could ever move in that direction?
Well, for one thing, I'm not convinced that that's the best approach, because people need meaningful work. So what I've proposed in The Real Wealth of Nations to deal, I've got a whole chapter on robotics and technology. I mean, you know, I think that, yeah, I mean, we have to redefine what is productive work. So my idea is to train people to care for people and to
mm-hmm.
give them stipends to do it, but not to just hand out money. That's
yeah.
just not a healthy thing to do.
Well, and I don't think it would be like just welfare. I think, you know, I think they have to go to school or they have to somehow work for it or volunteer or something. I don't think it's just
I don't get
the impression it's a free handout.
If that is there, and I really would appreciate it if you sent me something on that, be very interested in seeing it. But if there are, you know, if they have to volunteer, you know, provide some care, if they have to go to school to do something. I mean, look, the only work that machines really can't properly do is to be creative and to be caring, right?
Right.
And so that's what we should encourage people to do, and we should have a tremendous... Well, in my book on education, In Tomorrow's Children, I propose that caring for life, for self, for others, and for a Mother Earth be part of the curriculum from preschool to graduate school. So we're talking about a cultural transformation, aren't we?
Right, I think so.
That's what I've been working for.
Well, you know, when you think about your work, Rianne, I mean, you have been so courageous. I mean, here you put out a book about herstory and goddesses and our, you know, patriarchal culture. And, you know, you put out this other book about the real wealth of nations, talking about these other cultural transformations. Has it been difficult? I mean, has there been, pushback? I mean, people writing you and say you're...
haven't had much of that. I think that it's really interesting. Well, I have a way of saying some of these things, that if people actually bother to read my work, it is not offensive. Because, look, what's the point? I mean, all you do when you do that, if you say you're bad, right, or the corporation is bad or whatever, you get people defensive. So I try to make it possible for people to see what's in it for them. Okay?
Yes, and you're really good at that. I've noticed how, you know, you're really good with the language and you master the language very well, because it, like you said, you know, you if you want them to listen and consider your ideas, you certainly can't offend them. And I mean, you're even, well, I know in the chapter of the chapter that you submitted to the Voices of the Sacred Feminine anthology, you talked about how corporations can actually get a return on investment if they don't exploit their workers. But, of course, you don't put it that way. I'm putting it that way. And because, you know, we can't really just rely, I think, on anyone or corporations to do the right thing because it's the right thing. You have to prove to them that there's something in it for them, right? I mean...
Well, as long as the system is structured as it is now, in terms of a consumer economy, which is totally unsustainable, by the way, because of the fact that there aren't going to be enough jobs. We have to really... The Real Wealth of Nations has the building blocks for what we have to do, which is to really start creating a whole different way of thinking about economics. But as long as we're still in the system, you have got to prove that. And that's why, to get back to the social wealth economic indicators, to the SWAYs, they are tools for really showing people in government and people in business who have the power to make the decisions that it's in their best interest to have more caring policies. And I really emphasize caring policies because, the notion of nobody having private property, it's so unrealistic. Look at what happened. The Soviet Union turned into a domination system. I mean, I was there, invited with a group of women, Nordic Women for Peace, years ago. And, oh, my God, I mean, while they ate caviar, and served us caviar, people were just dying for some of the things that we take for granted, even people who live here under very poor circumstances. So, you know, you have to really, I mean, I'm very realistic, I'm very pragmatic, but at the same time I have a vision of something that's possible. And yes, the how we consider women and the feminine is key. to that cultural transformation and to a more just and caring world.
So how far away are we, you think, from having, you know, our government or our, I'm not sure if that's the right word, from actually using these sways? I mean, have you been able to, you know, convince, you know, people who make these sorts of decisions that, you know, we need to expand beyond the GDP, or is that one of the projects that the Center for Partnership has on its plate at
well,
this point
in time?
Well,
I think that I'm not the only one who says that we have to look beyond GDP. There are a lot of alternative measures floating around, but the only ones that have a gender component that's powerful, and the only ones that really show the economic value of the work of care and why it's so important for both quality of life and for economic success are the sways. And no, we have not convinced the government to adopt them. You know, change, it takes a while, but we're not going to give up. And so
yeah,
I want to invite people to donate to support the Center for Partnership Studies, and you can do that by going to caringeconomy.org.
Okay, well, I sent my donation in.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you, Rianne. I have enjoyed speaking with you, and I so admire the work you're doing out there in the world. You've really been a role model and a mentor, and I think just an incredibly courageous, smart woman. And, you know, I'm so glad I found your book. That's all I can say. Well, as we wrap this up, is there anything you want to say to close? Anything else about the Partnership Society, or did you want to give the website again? Or I give you the last word here.
Oh, thank you. Well, I can give you three websites. One is centerforpartnership.org. The other one is caringeconomy.org. And the last one is RianEisler.com. So I look forward. You can sign up for our mailing list. You can take our webinars. And you can certainly read my books and let me know what you think of them. So I thank you, Karen, and keep up your wonderful spiritual work.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Rianne, and have a wonderful holiday, and no doubt we will chat again soon. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, my dear. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Blessings to you, too. Bye-bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Always a pleasure to talk to Rianne. Well, that about does it for tonight. We're not going to have a long show. But I do want to thank all of you listeners who tuned in last night to my special second episode of the Goddess Calling audiobook series. It was called Resolutions and Return of the Light. I saw a lot of you downloaded it, and in fact, double the amount of downloads that I normally get. So thank you for that. I hope you enjoy it, and in a few weeks we will put another one out. And that is an audio series from the book Goddess Calling. So if you hear enough of these, maybe you'll decide that you have to have the book at your nightstand to maybe give you some inspiration, and you can enjoy some of the meditations, which I will also be sharing as a way to do a little bit of ritual on the radio. So I want you to remind you to remember who you are. As I've said here before on the show, you are the cognitive minority. And in the words of Gandhi, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. Or as author Schopenhauer, the philosopher, said, all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. And I do believe we're living in the evolution now. I think what we see every day is what it looks like. I think if we're realistic, I don't think we could have thought that we would just wake up and one day everything would be changed. You know, it is a struggle, and change takes a long time to come about. So just keep doing what you're doing to be the change, and walk your talk and usher in good vibrations and elevated consciousness. And, you know, this time of the year, as we try as best we can with the hecticness of the season, try to find those moments for yourself to sort of marinate in the darkness so that you can renew yourself, so that you can recharge your batteries and, you know, get those creative juices flowing again. And I have to say, as much as I respect Rhianne, I'm still a Bernie girl. I'm not sure she's really looked closely at his platform, but I certainly respect her her opinions. And I would just encourage everyone out there, if you really want change, I don't know about you, but I don't want to tinker around the edges. I really think our whole government has been pulled so far right that, you know, a candidate that, you know, really sort of offers just Republican light, you know, ideas, which is, I think, what we've had for so long, is not enough. I think we have to start thinking about our quality of life and, you know, changing things, you know, rather drastically. I mean, I remember when I first had a job as a secretary, I mean, just a lowly secretary. I wasn't in management. And we used to have benefits. And, you know, we didn't have this sort of job insecurity. And, you know, life really was, was much more secure than it is today. You know, corporations were not running amok. You know, things have really gotten so far out of hand. I really do believe what Bernie Sanders says. We really do need a revolution, in a sense, because you know, we have let corporations just run amok, and they control our lives. And we really do have an oligarchy. We don't have a democracy anymore. And if we think we do, I think we're just burying our head in the sand. So anyway, I do recommend you go to the Center for Partnership Studies, though. Wonderful stuff there that Rhianne is teaching. I believe they're creating some wonderful Pied Pipers that will, you know, help perpetuate this message of partnership that I think is part of the idea of the revolution, quite frankly. And I myself am going to be taking some of those classes I think some of them start in January, and then some of them start in March. So take a look, and at the very least, take a closer look at her wonderful books. And please, by all means, if you have not read Chalice and the Blade, that is a must. That is definitely a book you have to have. So in closing tonight, dear listeners, I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I hope you have a nice holiday. I'm going to have some comfort food, and as silly as it might sound, I am looking forward to green bean casserole and macaroni and cheese and maybe some ham and things that you know, I guess I stop myself from eating all during the year because I feel so guilty about it. Maybe some Napoleons for dessert. Maybe a couple Mai Tais, too. all right. I guess that's about it for me tonight. I hope you enjoyed Richard Wolff last week. I think he's another person that said a lot that we probably need to know. I really don't think he said himself that academia has not been doing their job teaching people about the alternative styles of government. You know, that we have really demonized anything but capitalism. And and, you know, and I have to say, you know, Bernie Sanders is not talking about turning the United States into a socialist government. You know, so if anyone assumes that, that is absolutely wrong. So anyway, I guess that's it. Thank you so much. As we get close to closing down 2015, the next show will be on the 29th. with a guest of mine by the name of Shona, and we're going to be talking about reawakening ancient, let's see, I have it right here, I think I had it. No, I don't. I apologize for that. I should have been more prepared. But I believe it's we're going to be reawakening, you know, ancient goddess beliefs as one thing we can do to, you know, universal goddess beliefs to bring us into more elevated awareness, being more in touch, more in touch with our bodies, and because she's actually a modern medicine woman, Shona is, and you know, we're just going to have a conversation along those lines. You know, bringing wise woman back into modern culture and time to reclaim our lost cultures. I think that's, you know, that would be a good way to probably describe the show. So that will be the closing show of 2015. But I am running a bunch of reruns the last 2 weeks of December as sort of a gift to all of you out there. So these will not show up in your email inbox, however. So you will not get notice of them if you hit the follow button. The way the system works, reruns will not automatically come to you to just click on the button. You'll have to actually go to the show page if you like to, you know, look at some of those. And some of the reruns that have already ran, I'll just tell you what some of them are in case you want to make sure you don't miss them. One was Noam Chomsky and Lane Redman. That one is there for you. You just have to scroll down from my show page. Margot Adler, Sacred Knowledge. That was a rerun we ran. Another one, which I thought was awesome, with Ken Worthy, Finding Human's Place in Nature, and also Witch Hunting Women in Capitalism. It was so interesting because you could see a direct connection from witch hunting to when capitalism comes along and how that manifested and the connections there. You know, who would have thought? Also, Selena Fox and the Pagan Roots of Christmas. One of the other shows I did at the top of the month was Becoming a Goddess with Renee Storr. And interestingly, Kathy Pagano, our resident astrologer, she did a prediction about the presidential election, which puts Bernie in the White House. So if you want to go back, that one is not too far down the show page. And as I said, you know, I've put out two episodes from the Goddess Calling audiobook series. One is Resolutions and Return of the Light, and the other is Separating Truth from Myth. Okay, well, I am going to say goodnight now. I've kept you too long, but I do want to just say thank you. I know you have lots of choices and you're very busy, so when you spend your time with me, know that it is appreciated. You are the gas in my tank. Good night, dear listeners. Merry Christmas, and I'll be back with you next week.
Okay, Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million, what color is the White House?
I know this.
5 seconds.
Oh, switching to Geico could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay. Judges? That's true, Kevin. They'll allow it. Congratulations. You're a winner.
Woo! Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.